Well, I'm really glad I came today because I just feel like my eyes have really been opened. And I kind of feel like as someone who's been an early feminist, this is kind of like the problem that had no name that's been named. And now that it's been named, I can really see how pervasive it is. One of the things we've done in my union is we try to have monthly meetings. Not everyone comes, of course, but we emphasize face-to-face contact with social events, meetings, workshops. I know some other unions on our campus rely on email to get a hold of their membership. I recently had read something about, we're doing a campaign on bullying and things like that, so I've been reading things about psychology and human interaction, and one of the things I had read says that the less you have face-to-face interactions with a team or a group, the less people trust each other,
right.
Which makes perfect sense. So, and this presentation today makes me realize that, you know, we even need to step up what we're doing and get more face-to-face communication and people knowing who their union members are in the workplace. One of the things about the texting and technology and these changes is I really agree with you, Charlie, that I think fundamentally we need face-to-face human contact. You know, from the time we're born until the time we die, I think that that's an essential need. And I think the younger generation doesn't know what they're missing, and they don't know what it is, and maybe the role of us older people in the union may be to introduce them to that. Maybe start out with the texting, the Facebook, or whatever, but then pull people into the human, in-person social interactions, because I really fear for the future of our society if people can't connect with each other anymore. And it really scares me that a whole generation doesn't even want to talk on the phone, let alone face-to-face. And I think this may be something that, you know, we not only need to talk about, but need to find ways to help the next generation move into a situation where they're comfortable and have the social skills that they haven't learned or are lacking.
Right.
Hi, Christine, customer service. I'm going with the bargaining thing. I mean, and I'm saying that because we just recently got our 1% raise, and everybody was like, "Oh, wow!" I mean, we got something. Something's better than nothing. And I think we need to stop that, because when you go to the bargaining table, you need to stick with what you're bargaining for. I mean, they always, you know, bring it down from 0%, this, that, that, never. When actually, you know, stand your ground, state what you want, stop settling for less, and that's my feeling on that issue.
I wanted to make a comment. You know, people are raising this issue of the generation gap, and one of the aspects of working alone that I think is also seriously problematic is that the bridging of gaps that exist in society that used to happen in the workplace. So I worked with older and younger people, and we interacted, you know, we weren't isolated from each other. We weren't texting. We were talking to each other about how to get this huge piece of steel up there and make it stay up where it's supposed to. So there was interaction across generations in the workplace. Interaction across races. When I had a welder, most often that welder was African American because of the racial breakdown of the shipyard. So I spent 8 hours a day interacting with and connecting to someone of a different race. That led to connections outside of work. I'd go to parties at his house, and he'd come to parties at my house, and there were connections being made. When they eliminated that and made me do my own welding, they also eliminated that interaction and that connection. And you can see it around gender, you can see it around race, and you can see it around age. And I think, you know, the workplace was a leveler that allowed connections across. I mean, despite all the problems of racism and gender separation in workplaces, it also allowed some connections that don't happen as much in larger society. The people, the white people I worked with, and my department in the shipyard was more white than welding or the labor gangs. That's the way the shipyard was set up. They didn't have any interaction with African Americans at home because they lived in segregated communities. Their only interaction with people that was different, their only positive interaction with people who were different was in the workplace. So as they break that down, I think it's actually heightening some of the divisions that already exist in society, including the age gap and the question of how do we work across generations is being made more difficult.
So I just want to say something about your point one, because this has been, I'm really glad I came to, Charlie. So I have a class of 15 honors students here at the university. So they're the smart kids. 15.
Do they have to wear their "I'm a smart kid" on there? Yeah.
They are. They are. You know that it's. Anyways, regardless of that, and they know it. No, they're very nice and they're diligent students. And I wanted to teach labor studies the first time around to a group of diligent students who wanted to be there. For that age group, because we haven't talked to, as I started off by saying, we haven't talked to that age group. So anyways, they're nice kids. I can't get them to talk for anything. It's like dragging it on them. So they're 19 to like 27 years old. And it has been the hardest work teaching I have ever done, trying to get them to participate and talk in the class. But, you know, we're into it 10, 11 weeks, and they're moving along, and it's been great fun, really interesting. Charlie actually presented this stuff at one of the classes. So, out of the clear blue sky, two or three classes ago, Patricia's in the middle of the room, they're doing an activity, and she says to me, "So what is solidarity?" Mm-hmm. And I was dumbstruck.
Right.
I was dumbstruck. You know, solidarity. I started, right. You know, I didn't know what to say to her, because my answer would be, well, it's, you know, unions working together and support, was meaningless to her.
Right.
It would be meaningless. So I kind of like just blew her off and didn't say anything. And you know, only today, Charlie, have I actually deconstructed solidarity and thought I could say to Patricia, it's people knowing each other, interacting face to face and caring about each other. It's, you know, groups getting together and supporting. Now I could give her an answer that's meaningful. So for me, one of the things I want to say I'm taking away from this is to kind of go back to our base.
Yeah.
You know, it's what, who said it about the traditional ed? You said it. I mean, this is partially what I'm trying to teach in the class is we're on the wrong track fighting just for wages and benefits. We can't get them anyways, so why bother? But we're on the wrong track because we lost the human element. So it's been great, Charlie, to really think about what that means and what's behind it.
I think,
and why these kids don't have it.
I just want to underline that, you know, this we use the term solidarity all the time, and yet, like Susan said, you know, can you define it? And it's
solidarity for us is network for them.
Solidarity for us is different than it is for most of the people that we work with, right? For us, it's an ideology. It's a notion that we believe in. For other people, it's a human connection. Right, we never talked about solidarity in my group that walked out that time, and yet we were the most solidaristic group that I've ever worked with. These guys would, you know, go to the mat for each other, and it wasn't about connection to the union. It was about connection to each other.
Yes,
that's
yes.
What got us moving.
Yes,
you know, Connor, I think changes in social attitudes have made a big difference in solidarity in general. I mean, people, fathers and sons used to have businesses together, small family shops. That doesn't exist anymore. That's going away. Fathers and sons used to go into trades together. They don't anymore. You know, people used to belong to churches. They don't anymore. I mean, you ride through communities and you see churches being turned into condos.
Right.
You know, I mean, that kind of bothers me in a sense that, wow, we really have gotten off the reservation as far as anything that answers to social, you know, no matter what religion you are, your church was your social focus. And when you don't have that, how can you understand anything else that has a social focus to it?
Speaking of the church, I see Father Pat's
hand. Solidarity in Catholic thought, since John Paul II, is much more prominent. However little it's practiced at times. That got behind, JP2 got that out of his experience in Poland. Mm-hmm. The twist of this for management for me is that the solidarity they did was a reaction to the domination of Polish communism. A second thing is that we had for years talking about Taylorization. What we have now is computerized Taylorization.
Super Taylorism.
And in John's John Paul II's letter on human labor, he hits upon this very easily from his background. He talks now about solidarity is not just something personal, but something very sacred. And in that letter, you get a real rap on contracting out, outsourcing. The fact that he says, when outsourcing takes place, the formerly direct employer, now the indirect employer, loses none of his responsibility to look out for the worker. And he has a large section in there on humanizing the workplace. And I think we can, you may touch some people with this, some people won't even listen to you, but the theme of his letter is co-creation. No matter what work we do, we are co-creating the universe. This nonsense takes it away from us and puts us into a domination by management. And I'm delighted that the state of Massachusetts still has labor studies programs, because in Pennsylvania, they're gone.
Yeah.
And I think that whether it's high school teachers or college teachers, we have to get across to the students that they tried the original Taylorization. They tried to sneak by us to talk about co-management, co-participation, as Tom Donahue, when he was VP or Secretary Treasury AFL-CIO, was saying at that time in the 80s, oh, yeah, they want co-management. They're going to give us co-participation and so forth. But what they did was steal the ideas,
right,
and no feedback, positive feedback. Then they went into quality work circles, and they backfired on them, because the way they were working the quality work circles, the workers finally began to realize this is all fake. That failed, so they're into this.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I've got a whole rap on quality circles and employee involvement, but one could argue that's what I call capturing the collective. So it's creating collective interaction, but it's creating it under very controlled conditions that are directed at management goals, so it's not independent organization. Just 2 points I wanted to draw out of what you said. One is, we are increasingly facing global employers, and the call for international solidarity is increasing, and we need that. But my argument, I would argue that if you can't get people to feel solidarity with their coworkers, you're never going to get them to feel solidarity with some worker across the ocean. And so that it's diminished as the base of solidarity diminishes, it also diminishes the possibility of large-scale solidarity that we need to take on corporations. The other point was the contractor issue. I mean, you know, the BP disaster in Texas City, everybody that died was a contractor. Yeah. And so the ability to sort of say, well, they're not really us, for the unionized workers who were the core workers at that workplace, they're not really us. You know, that distinction, that separation, is a serious problem. We all work in the same workplace. We're all part of the same work process. In fact, we're all part of the same work process, even if that work process is distributed around the globe like it so often is now. Figuring out how to create those ties is really critical. Tali.
Tali Graham from Maskosh. I kind of can't believe I'm saying this, but I do feel like we kind of need to suck it up as the older organizers here and really look at the social networking as a tool that we can use better. And I didn't get to say it into this thing, but I do think I've had a similar experience to Susan doing when we used to have the Office Technology Education Project. Uh-huh. I used to go in and do workshops with them, and often it was individual people in the computer world, and I talked to them about solidarity and organizing, and I got the same thing. They looked at me like I had six heads on my shoulder. And I do think that we have to look more closely at what we think of solidarity as other people thinking is networking, and deconstruct that a little bit and create some tools for ourselves to fit some of what you're saying. And I just have, I've heard a couple of small experiences where people have used texting to save people. When there were raids down in New Bedford, people were texting each other, get out now. Yeah. You know, and we don't have to start of what people think of people, you know, undocumented people being there. But that was a form of solidarity, and it was a way that people organized that maybe some of us don't know how to do. So I just want to put it out there. We need some tools. We need to really be critically thinking and talking to the young people who see the social networking as something that they feel that they can create social change about.
I really am not arguing that we should throw away technology. You know, I walk around with more technology than sent the first. We are afraid of it, and we do need to figure out how to use it, but I think we also need to understand that those face-to-face connections, those personal connections are critical. You know, I put pictures. I knew I was going to slip in a reference to my brand-new granddaughter, who's only 6 weeks old. But I put pictures of my granddaughter on my Facebook page, and I have no idea how to use Facebook. But what I know is my friends send me notes saying, oh my God, she's beautiful, right? And so it's a way to keep in contact, but I'm keeping in contact with people who I already have that very strong and very direct personal connection with, which is sort of, it's a hybrid. It's a model of bringing the two things together.
This may be overkill because Charlie said some of this, but I think it's important
to draw. You're going to talk about Annabelle too? Oh.
Yeah. No, actually, my granddaughter's seven.
Yeah, well.
And the scary thing is that Danny wants to put her in a summer camp where she'd learn how to make video games, which would really be awful. But I think it's there's an important distinction to be drawn between networking and solidarity. And I also think that we need to learn how to use these tools. I have a Facebook page, and my main worry about my Facebook page is that it cuts down once again the separation between work and home life, which I think is another scary thing about Facebook. But there's a real difference between networking and solidarity is that solidarity is networking plus being willing to take actions and sacrifice for the good of the rest. And networking very explicitly doesn't. It leaves it up to the individual to what extent they're gonna participate in something, and there's no social pressure to do anything. And social pressure in creating a social grouping, the social pressure sometimes can be bad. You know, very often the social pressure has resulted in exclusion, for example, or bullying or whatever. I mean, you know, it's social pressure created racist situations and sexist situations and everything else, but it also it creates a moral force that can get people to do things. And I think, you know, that Malcolm Gladwell article that Charlie referenced that was in the New Yorker, I think, you know, and which I put up on my Facebook page, I should say, is really worth reading for anybody who hasn't read it yet. Although, you know, I think it's got problems with it, but the difference between the strong connections that you make face-to-face and the weak connections that you make with Facebook or any other kind of social networking, which can get people hooked into things and can get people to have knowledge of a lot of stuff, but it doesn't really move people to action that is really the kind of sustained and action and deep action that is needed to make social change. Yes, you can sign another petition to, you know, let go such and such a political prisoner. You can do things like that. You can, you know, give a dime. But that's not what's really needed to make real social change.
You should read the New Yorker article, but you should also read Jeremy Brecker's response to the New Yorker article, which I think makes probably some of the points that you might raise as a concern. I want to, there's another difference between solidarity and social networking. Solidarity is about the workforce, it's about class, it's about people who operate under common conditions of oppression, right? And that's an important piece of it. We're coming together within a social construct of the workplace where we're all on one side of that workplace. That's an objective condition. So solidarity is, you know, it is connected to the workplace and to the question of work and the question of class. And I think that's could be a whole nother conversation about this, but I think it's what makes it really critical as well. Where are they? Oh, there.
Yeah. I just wanted to add something, and it's actually coming through my lens kind of as a clinician psychologist. Dealing with the whole issue of isolation. And what this made me think about is the whole notion of the power of beliefs and structuring reality. And beliefs are not necessarily truths, but they do structure what we think about as reality. And then there's a connection between beliefs and how they generate emotions and then subsequent actions. It's kind of like a triangulated relationship. And it's that kind of triangulated relationship that leads to the impetus for things like solidarity and so forth. Now, the connection I want to make here is that, and I've written a lot about this kind of thing, is that we simultaneously somehow live in what I call three life spaces. A personal life space, a societal life space, and a global life space. The personal life space for me is all of the encounters that we have with other people face to face and create emotions, thoughts, and operate out of that in terms of our actions and so forth, powered by our beliefs and so forth. But they are face to face encounters. Societal life space that we live in is all the things that we've heard about, thought about, read about, and so forth, but we don't have any direct face-to-face encounters with these events, people, what have you. So it's secondary to our experience. Yet we create powerful beliefs, emotions that relate to all of these kinds of activities. And so we structure our realities based on that from a societal point, life space point of view. Similarly, with global life space, it's secondary. It's all the things you read about, heard about, read about in terms of the global space, but we don't have any direct face-to-face encounters with that. Yet we create emotions, thoughts, and feelings around it and take actions based on all of that construction. So the implication for me that I found myself thinking about was, well, how does this play itself out in the generational thing that we were talking about? Yeah. If we think about young people, and this is actually based on conversations I've had with my daughter, I asked her once, like, well, why do you spend so much time, you know, on your,
Not even a cell phone.
It's like the tweaking back and forth and the Facebook and what have you. She says, well, it allows me to do multiple things and it takes less time. So I interact that way. And I create strong feelings about the people I'm interacting with. So I said, okay, that's her construction of reality. That's very real. That's her belief. And it's very, very real in terms of how she feels about the people. She may not have any direct face-to-face encounters at all. She has some folks who are actually in the global world, and she has very strong feelings about these folks. Have not even seen them. But they're very real in her mind. And she operates in that particular reality. So the question is, how do you tap into that kind of experience, with young folks who, in fact, have constructed their belief systems in their societal life space and global life space to say, these are things that are real going on in their minds. And they may not have any direct face-to-face encounters with. How do you tap into that in terms of organizing so that, because that's how the, you know, if they're feeling strongly about something, then they may act on it because in their minds they believe it, and therefore you get your solidarity trickling from that. Mm-hmm. But that's the challenge, I think, that's at play, you know, in today's world.
I mean, one of the things that I see within the labor movement is we're divided by beliefs, right? Union members believe in lots of different things. And so the social space that you talk about is dominated, in fact, a lot by Fox News and, you know, the bad guys, right? Increasingly, the media that's dominating that space and that conversation. And so if at the same time we're losing the personal space, and in particular, again, I'm going to go back to the workplace, personal space that's based on common experience. We're both being oppressed, and we connect to each other. So when we're taking action on that, we have a personal connection, and frankly, what she believes in about God's guns and gays doesn't matter to me because I have a personal connection. If I don't have that personal connection, then the belief systems kick in as a more powerful determinant of whether or not we're going to do something together. And I think we're, you know, we've seen in the last set of elections and all of that, that we are suffering from that belief system that is not countermanded by a direct personal connection of solidarity.
Before I hand this back to Christine, I wanted to take advantage of having it to share a story from an IBEW member who couldn't make it here today. And we were talking about some of this stuff on the phone as I was encouraging him to come, and I was raising the issue of home garaging. And his response to me was, home garaging is great. We love home garaging, but we have insisted through our contract that the day starts with a half-hour tailgating meeting. So even though we're home garaging and we're getting the benefits of that, we are controlling the work day enough so everybody's coming together for a meeting face-to-face to start our day. So one thing is, how do we get sort of, as we're talking about technology, how can we take advantage of the benefits that this technology gives us without losing that fundamental human interaction, that development of relationships? And for me, that comes back to this idea of bargaining and bargaining and bargaining, right?
And
so what are we demanding and what are we trying to control? Yeah. And how do we pay attention to this stuff so we don't lose it all?
Hi, I want to piggyback on, I forget what Cuffin said. I have nieces that's 18 and 30 years old. And basically, if you ask them and they are comfortable with you and you just, whatever the conversation is based on, they'll express their feelings. Yes, on Facebook, you can go on there and actually see what they're writing about. And then if you respond to their comments, they'll come back. So, I mean, I think basically it's they're wanting us to accept them as an adult, okay, because for some reason or another, when they turn 18, they automatically think they're an adult. My response to my niece is, you're not an adult, but you're of legal age. So since you want to be treated that way, here's conversations that adults talk about. What do you think about that? So if you come to them on a level of not making them feel like you're controlling what they're thinking or what they want to do, they'll respond to you in a manner of they're comfortable to discuss whatever the topic may be.
So it's rapidly approaching 11 o'clock, and this has been a great conversation. I'd love to continue it. And certainly if people want to do follow-up, if they want to have further conversations, I'm available at any time to do that. I guess I would sum up by saying I think this is a critical issue that has not been acknowledged, is not commonly seen as a critical issue, but it's something we have to start paying attention to. The changes that I list, the changes that are taking place in our workplaces are not going to slow down. We haven't reached a plateau where we can sort of rebuild. They're ongoing, and in fact, they're accelerating. And that if we don't sort of get on top of this and start figuring out what the actual issues are and how we can bargain over these things, how we can make a difference on these things, I'm fearful for the core base of solidarity that's so critical to any kind of workers' movement that's going to make a difference in this world where power is increasingly disparate, and we really need to pay attention to this. So thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. So we have a couple of ideas for continuing the conversation, and one of them is electronic and isolated.
Yeah.
First, I would like to thank our audio technician, Chuck Rosina. And we've been experimenting with ways to make thinking big. You know, as I always say, what's our job here? Labor Resource Center. It's to be a resource to you, and it's to take what you do and try to chisel it in a wall, not write it at the tideline. So we've been experimenting with ways that you might use what happens in Thinking Big in a follow-up. So for the previous ones, we have slideshows up, we have video. No one was looking at them. They were cumbersome. They took a lot of resources to do. So what we're trying this time is what we think is an easier technology, which is the podcast. So this will be there. You can go back and slide that little thing and listen to parts. You can listen to yourself, see how you sound like. So you can work on, see what you sound like. You can work on your presentation later if you need to. So I think that we'll try to do a couple of other things, which I haven't talked to Annette or Charlie or anybody about. But I think that we can provide, well, and we are very pleased to be releasing Charlie's paper. Today's the release date for Charlie's report here. So that's a resource to you, and you have a hard copy, and there'll be a PDF connected to the same place where the podcast for this is. I think we'll try to link the Gladwell article and mm-hmm. Jeremy Brecker's responses.
Yeah.
I also think we might try to do a little bloggy thing, particularly on this issue of what is solidarity. Let's see if we can do something like that so we can find a place where we can kind of collect these thoughts and get a chance to write them down. Just finally, on what we're doing for you with your tax dollars, we have an upcoming social and cultural event that is one of those places where labor people can create an alternative to what's been lost. And I wonder if anybody in the room can tell me what the upcoming cultural event is.
What do you mean we have?
There are two organizers of the cultural event in the room.
And they don't even know.
Because, see, they're not thinking of it this way. They're just thinking of, if I get the art show up in the gallery, I get the competency and the grade. Christine and Marty are part of a group of students who, as part of their art and culture competencies, will be mounting Stephen Lewis's labor poster show at the UMass Art Gallery.
We will.
Oh, Christine, you're not on that. What am I saying? Marty, you're not on that. You're not. Never mind you. Marty and there's about eight students, so I lost track of who they were. So that'll be for the month of March. And the reason we're doing the month of March is, well, the gallery was available. But March is also the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and the death of 100 women because they didn't have a union there. So we'll all be getting invitations to that. I hope you'll come out at some point, see the exhibit. Maybe you'll organize a group. Maybe you'll bring some of your union members. We'll be having a reception. I'm hoping we're going to have maybe a couple of gallery talks during the course of that month. So we'll be letting you know that. And it would be a place to bring, Stephen's show is great, this historical collection of labor posters. So I encourage you, usually I just give the pitch, hey, we're doing this thing, maybe you'll come. But I encourage you to think of it as an opportunity to do that kind of social and cultural networking, exploring ways that we can do solidarity, build solidarity, especially among younger people. Lisa Lemieux is working on the photography project down there, and I'm hoping that actually down in southeastern Mass, they have a worker photography project they've been doing. And we're hoping that Lisa will actually bring some of that exhibit up as part of this, too, and have some of it here.
Might not be ready by then. I think it's going to be ready by around April, isn't it?
Spring.
Spring, yeah. Some spring. Well, maybe we'll just have Lisa come up with a few samples and do a gallery talk or something. So let me see, face-to-face art show blog report. We'll be back again doing this in about 6 months. Thank you again, Charlie.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Feel free. clean out all the food. Sorry, Christine, I'll give you another shot.
There we go.
Thank you.
All I could think of was the mine shaft and gazelle shaft. It's never at a date.
Yeah. All right.
How you feeling?
I'm hanging in. I'm on another clinical trial. I'm one of their favorite lab rats over at Dana-Farber. Yeah, because basically I'm healthy other than cancer. So.